Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about Tech Tent from our webpage. Go to bbc.com/programs/techtent.
Hello and welcome to Tech Tent, your weekly update on the technology business with me, Jane Wakefield. And joining me in a very hot tent, yes, London is experiencing a heat wave, are Dave Lee.
Hello.
And LJ Rich from BBC World's Click Programme.
Hello.
And also joining us in the tent this week is my very distinguished special guest, Vidya Lakshmi Karthikeyan, BT's most prolific female inventor, with her name on 16 patent applications, no less. Hi.
Hi there.
So first up, we told you last week about a rather cryptic memo to Microsoft staff from their new chief executive, Satya Nadella. But this week, his plans became more clear. The deepest cuts at Microsoft in its 39-year history. Kim Gittleson joins us on the line from New York to tell us more. Hello, Kim.
Hey, how are you? So, right, Mr. Nadella made clear that he would be cutting 18,000 jobs. Now, that's significantly more than the nearly 6,000 jobs his predecessor, Steve Ballmer, cut in 2009. Most of those cuts, around 12,500, will be in the Nokia handset division. Microsoft bought Nokia in April. That's seen as sort of hedging bets around the risky phone market. The rest will be sort of as Microsoft tries to move from its software base into a cloud future. The move was cheered by investors. The stock rose over 1% when they were announced. It's up 22% over the year because the company has grown to 127,000 employees. Now, that's up from 57,000 a decade ago. For context, Apple, which is just a year younger than Microsoft, has 85,000 employees. So Microsoft has about 50% more people. And Apple made double as much profit last year. So this is a move that is seen as a jolt to the company's culture. It's seen as something that they need to do to move into the future. You know, but some analysts were sort of wondering if that was enough. They were hoping for larger job cuts, and they were hoping for bigger changes. Mr. Nadella also announced that he would be cutting the Xbox TV studio and that Nokia will no longer make an Android phone. But some wonder if that's really enough to sort of jump into the future.
There was better news, though, for Yahoo and Intel, I hear.
That is true. Now, Yahoo missed all of its targets and its profit decreased, but that's not what investors were looking for. They wanted to see how much they would get from Alibaba. That's the Chinese internet giant. Yahoo owns a big portion of that company, and it is set to make a public share offering later this year. Yahoo said in their earnings that they were going to be giving at least 50% of the proceeds of that sale to their shareholders, so that clearly rang a bell for them. And Intel, in an interesting twist, said that its sales of PCs had increased in the quarter. You know, that's a really big difference from what we've been seeing earlier, that PC sales are on a decline. And it also coincides with a report by a research firm, NPD Group, that said that tablet sales had declined for the first time in the first 3 months of this year. So possibly a shift on the horizon there. Intel saw its share price, of course, increase as well.
Okay, thank you. So that was Kim talking from New York. And moving on to some of the other top tech news this week, how many of you remember this?
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
Some might recognise that clip from Apple's 1984 advert, which, as well as referencing George Orwell's book of the same name, was also widely seen as poking fun at the big established industry rival, IBM. Dave Lee, now they want to be friends, don't they?
Yes, they do. We spoke last week, didn't we, about how Microsoft was desperate to impress normal consumers rather than business. Well, this is the other way around. Apple now, which really has a big footing in consumer business, now wants to attract the enterprise market. So it wants to tempt more businesses to use their products. Now, we don't know many specific terms of the deal and what exactly it's going to involve, but we imagine, and there's a good indicator, that Apple are interested in IBM's very significant big data capabilities, you know, the ability to crunch numbers to get real business intelligence. So that's what we're expecting from them.
Nvidia, Apple is seen as a sort of consumer brand, IBM as a business brand, but are we sort of, with these sort of tie-ups, moving more to an age where those boundaries are disappearing?
Yes, I think so. And that's the case for computing used in a number of sectors, I think, not just in computing itself, but it's used in other sectors as well. I think what with initiatives like Bring Your Own Device, you know, a lot of work is going on in terms of apps, interoperability between different devices, between standalone devices, between, you know, network devices, and we really should be expecting a lot of that.
But it hasn't all been good news for Apple this week, has it? They're not particularly friendly with the European Commission at the moment.
No, Apple today got a real turning off from the European Commission today. They say that Apple isn't doing enough to stop consumers being misled about in-app purchases. So those are the things where you'd get an app for free, particularly a game, for example, but once you have that game, it will then tempt you to spend, you know, a few dollars here and there, or even more, on enhancing the game or getting through it quicker. The European Commission says Apple isn't doing enough. It praised Google for making some progress in that area, but Apple was on the sharp end of their statement today.
Well, as a parent, I'm definitely in favour of anything that can be done to stop my children spending my money. So thanks, Dave. Now, you might remember on LJ's last appearance in the tent, she treated us to some of her lovely singing. So we've decided we're going to make it a tradition that whenever she's on the show, we'll have a musical interlude. Here's her latest tech creation. LJ, what have you been up to?
Well, iBeacons are generally the size of a large biscuit or a small pan of chocolate, and they use Bluetooth low energy to transmit data to specific location zones. What you're listening to is the result of something that I co-built that's going to be on Click next week. London's Regent Street is rolling out a huge installation of iBeacons, and when you install the Regent Street app, when you walk past a shop with one, it normally pings you an offer or some information. So what happened was Jakub Tomanik and I had the idea over a very strong coffee last Friday, the result of which was I mapped the beacons in Regent Street using an Android app. Then each beacon gets assigned a music track that I composed. So we use the signal strength as a volume control. So when you walk around Regent Street, the closer you get to one particular beacon, the louder one particular track becomes. So it means that you become a human mixer, mixing the tracks based on how close you are. And the best bit is you get the Regent Street offers at the same time while the app is running.
It sounds crazy, but also amazing.
And that's on next week's show, actually.
You're listening to Tech Tense on the BBC World Service. I'm Jane Wakefield. Dave Lee is rather outnumbered in the tech tent today, but while we may have girl power here, it isn't the case in the wider tech industry. Globally, only 10% of tech entrepreneurs are women, according to a recent piece in The Economist magazine. The stats are slightly better in the Middle East, where 35% are women. Startup founder and angel investor Hala Fadel, who chairs the MIT Enterprise Forum of the Pan-Arab Region, told Manuela Sargosa she thinks Middle Eastern women are actually more comfortable taking risks than their male counterparts.
The men want to have an established position where they have a recurring income, whereas a woman would maybe care less about that.
There is something about women leadership in the Middle East, and that's, I know, breaks every cliche of what you would think the Middle East is about. But even in a small village, you can see lots of women on the ground taking the initiative to feed the village, to feed the family, to take action in a deprived area, to change things. So there is something about women leadership.
And I think there's a lot of solidarity between women. Like, as an angel investor in the Middle East, I actually have an example of a winner from also 3 years ago, Perihan Abuzaid.
This is a winner of
the MIT Arab Startup Competition. She started an online TV, and now she's starting another startup, and I'm an angel investor in her business now. And it took me seconds to decide, because she's already a serial entrepreneur.
It's interesting that you said the fact that she was a woman was also an extra factor that made you want to invest in her. What is it about female entrepreneurs that makes them more appealing, do you think?
I think the era of having, you know, one founder that is a superstar in a company is just over. It's about teamwork. It's about the world has become so complex and so global that you really need to be an A-team to create a tech startup. And women know how to surround themselves with A-people because their ego is just is not as big as the one of men. So I really like their leadership style.
Hala Fadel with a Middle Eastern perspective there. Vidya, India also seems to have a higher proportion of women that go into tech.
Yes, indeed.
And are quite comfortable going into tech jobs. Why is that? And what can we in the West learn from that?
Well, I think one thing to bear in mind about statistics about women going into technology in places like India is that there is still a lot of gender diversification. And if the further question to really ask is, what is the distribution of women going into things like mechanical engineering, chemical engineering versus IT? Mm-hmm. So you will find a huge discrepancy in that. So it's worth taking that statistic with a pinch of salt. That's
right.
Worth pointing out. But then having said that, you're absolutely right. It is true that women are much more comfortable going into technology disciplines, STEM-related disciplines in
STEM
in
being science, technology,
engineering and maths, indeed. And I think... I obviously grew up in India, and then I moved out to Malaysia to an international school, and then I moved to the UK about 8 years ago. So you can say that I've sort of seen the systems through. I think there's a lot to be said for cultural difference, because when I was a child, and if I went up to my parents and I said, oh, I don't like maths. I don't like science or chemistry. I'm not taking to it. Absolutely every single effort would be taken to sort of make me better at it and so on. And there is this culture that being in science and technology is good. Children should be taken into it. And, mm-hmm. you know, sort of therefore, it's very important to not cut out your options when you don't quite know what the field is about.
Fantastic. In the West, experts generally agree that the problem starts at school. Mm. In the UK, for example, only 13% of computer studies exams that are taken by girls. There are now loads of coding clubs and events aiming to change that, and Jack Gill went along to one called Girls Get Coding at the Houses of Parliament in London, where schoolgirls aged between 9 and 12 were showing the politicians how to make a game.
I'm Ellie.
I'm Sonia.
I'm Jessica.
Tell me, Ellie, a little bit about this game that you're making here. What's it all about?
Well, it's a 3D world, and you got to program the Sputnik to eat the apples and avoid the obstacles. So if he eats apple, then he'll get points added on, and we've added a timer to make the game a little harder.
How long have you been coding?
So I've been coding since the start of the year, pretty much. I was Scratch, and then I decided to go into coding, see how it was.
What got you interested? Why did you want to have a look at coding?
Because it just sounds like interesting, because like you computer something. It's like a computer game, but you actually do it yourself and then play the game as well.
And do you think that you'll go on to become a computer programmer when you're older?
Well, I think I might, but I also have other plans as well, but I think I'm quite good at it.
And Ellie, do you think that we're going to see more girls getting into coding and computers than we have in the past?
Yeah, I think girls have found coding easier, a little easier than boys, because it's easier to pick up.
Why do you think girls have been put off in the past?
Well, maybe because they don't know these programs existed. And like now that computers have been around more and there's more, they will get into it.
So this week I booked a BT engineer to come to my house to fix a broadband problem. And I was quite surprised when a young woman turned up, surprised but also very pleased. But when I talked to her afterwards, she said that she regarded herself as a bit of a rare breed, that she'd heard tell of other women engineers, but she'd never actually met any. And it seems to me that girls sort of do love these kind of subjects, but then for some reason they don't necessarily take the jobs up in it, even though people like this engineer that I met did seem to love her job. Why do you think, Vidya, that it is that people just aren't getting into these jobs if they're women?
I think we start to notice the effect of the filtering process that takes place from a very, very early age on. So what we see at the 18, 19-year-old, 20-year-old girls not going into technology is a product of a lot of filtering. And at each of those different crucial ages, different factors play. So, for example, one of the things that I do a lot of work with student ambassadors and, you know, going out to speak to students in universities and schools and so on. And one of the things that I find is a lot of misinformation about what is engineering. I hear some really strange things, and I've never seen a single person, you know, sitting in a little room being isolated. It's a very social job. I think the other thing that I come across as well is the stigma that around being an engineer, being a scientist. And I think a lot of the work that STEM IT partners that do tech partnerships is very good in breaking out of that.
LJ, you're a woman with a lot of tech know-how. You fixed your own iPad, and we heard you hacking earlier on. For me, the issue is about why does this matter? You know, what is it that women are going to bring to a tech job that a man can't?
You see, and this is where it starts to get interesting. The trick is finding a place to work where these things don't get pushed to the foreground all the time. It's very easy for people to make assumptions, whether it's whether it's your gender, your race, how much money they think you have in the bank, anything else that they choose. It's human nature. And I've experienced some very impressive comments about things that I do based on everything from appearance to which loo I use at work. I think it's more about being able to create an environment, which I'm optimistic is slowly but surely going to happen, where all that matters is your ability to get on with other people, your ability to tolerate holding more than one idea of how something can be done at once, and above all, be in an environment where it's supported to be creative and innovative. And that way, when I did fix my iPad, no one said, oh, and you're a woman afterwards, which I found very refreshing.
Reassuring, yeah. Dave, I've noticed that you're not a woman.
No.
So what's the male perspective? Do you care that there's far more men in the tech industry than there are women?
I think it's an issue, isn't it, of if you have a company that's made up of men, bringing women into that organisation just adds perspective, and added perspective is never, ever a bad thing. Likely, in the same way that if you had a company that was run solely by women, bringing a man into that environment would add their perspective as well. So I think it's just diversifying, you know, who is in the industry.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, the thing that stood out in that interview was the girl who said that she liked coding, but she had other plans.
Yes.
And I think that's going to be the challenge, isn't it, to persuade girls that
yes.
to stay on the path of coding rather than all their other plans that they have. Never let it be said that I don't take my tech tent duties seriously. And part of that means venturing out of the tent occasionally to investigate the wonderful world of new tech. This week, I spent a very interesting hour driving around London's Docklands in a car named Stella that looked like it had been beamed in directly from the future. And anyone interested in seeing it for themselves can take a look on our Twitter feed.
Can we kind of close the door?
Yep. Okay. So everyone buckled up?
Yeah.
Yeah, good.
There we go. So first of all, tell us a bit about how it was built.
So we're currently driving the world's first solar-powered family car, which is built by 20 students from Eindhoven University of Technology in the Netherlands. We were students and we were looking at all these nice technologies, electric cars, and we thought, why is there a family car powered by solar energy? So we started doing the math, the physics, and we thought, it's possible. Why did nobody do it? We asked. Nobody did it because nobody thought of it somehow. So we just started.
You say it's the first family car. Does that suggest there's already other solar cars out there driving around?
There are already other solar cars driving around. It's been going on for decades. But these solar cars are not really cars. They are very flat and they have a place for only one person, which is very cramped up in an uncomfortable position. And that's where Stella, world's first solar-powered family car, is different. We are currently in the car with four people. We're having our seatbelts on. We're sitting. We can talk. We can have a conversation. Maybe 5 to 10 years, you will see these solar cars driving on the roads everywhere.
So obviously the power source is loads and loads of solar panels on the roof. I mean, today it's an absolutely gloriously sunny day. But if there's a bit of rain, what happens then? Will it still go?
The nice part of this car is it also has a battery package. And that battery makes sure that you can also drive at night when there is completely no sun. So the range of the car is 800 kilometers when it's sunny. But at night it's still 400 kilometers only based on the battery. There is, of course, another nice aspect. We have the solar panel on the roof. When you park your car outside and your battery is full, if we plug the car to the electric grid, using it to get the energy from the solar panel of your car to give it back to the grid. So you can do the laundry or charge your laptop from the energy from your car, which is very, very important, of course, because your car is free to drive. You get your energy from the sun, and it's not only energy neutral, it's even energy positive. Your car delivers energy to your house.
Andre Snook there from the solar team in Eindhoven. LJ, we've heard last week about solar-powered charging stations for mobile phones. Now we've heard about a solar-powered family car. And a recent crowdfunding scheme has raised over $2 million to fund a solar road scheme. Is the future going to lie in solar power?
Well, I think that as the solar cells become more efficient in their ability to return power, then, yes, this becomes a viable means of getting power. The other thing is that if you are somewhere where you aren't able to plug something in easily, and on my travels with Click, I've found myself sometimes very far away from sockets, and I have a solar charger that works brilliantly. I've also got a battery power block that's incredibly heavy but also does the job. I think for consumers, it's as long as you can get the power into your device, doesn't really matter that much where it comes from. Let's hope that we get a bit more eco though.
And Dave, is a lot of emphasis on cars that can produce energy in a much cleaner way, isn't there? There's some news on Tesla, I believe.
There is, yeah. I mean, we heard in the last week or so that Tesla have brought a new model of their car, which is a good 50% cheaper than the current Tesla car that they've been showing around. So that's their attempts to make this more affordable. As far as kind of solar goes, I guess one of the big problems they're going to have to tackle is just the feel of driving it. I mean, you even heard in the package there, it sounded like quite a creaky car kind of stumbling on the road. I mean, it's not quite your Porsche flying down the motorway, is it? So that's something they need to overcome, that kind of slightly cringeworthy element of solar cars.
Having said that, though, hybrid cars have got over the stigma of sounding a bit strange or not doing much in the way of acceleration.
By being artificially noisier.
Well, you know, I drive a hybrid. It's kind of cool to not have to pay so much for petrol. But this is all about iterations. Future iterations make things better.
Yes. It's very much about the evolution of technology and the time that it takes to get something that is practical, usable, and covers the distance that you want to cover.
I love the idea of the solar roads. I thought, that seems to me so obvious. It solves such a problem. But I must say that having gone in that solar-powered car, it does need some work. It was a bit like being in a tin can. It was excessively hot. And at the end, when I sort of went to lean on the roof to have a picture taken of me, they were like, don't touch the roof, it's really hot. And I think they might need to work on that a bit too. But, it's interesting.
It's part of the maker mentality. You have to be patient. When you kind of try to get something working, in fact, that beacon hack's a great example, it never works the first time. And it's going to be rubbish for a bit, and then it starts to get less rubbish, and then it begins to be quite good, and then it's wow. And it's that patience.
Yes.
People want this instant gratification, don't they?
Yes, absolutely.
A little bit of patience goes a long way.
I mean, that's actually part of being an engineer. You need to be comfortable with running something that you know isn't going to work, but you try it, and then you do it again, and then you do it again, and be comfortable with that failure and that uncertainty, and just perfecting that just takes time.
Failing is fun.
It was great to see these guys just coming up from a university and producing something like that that kind of worked on the roads and was something that you could imagine with a bit of tinkering becoming good.
And the infrastructure as well.
That's about all we've got time for. Solar definitely seems viable today because it's an absolutely glorious day here. And before we all go off to enjoy the sunshine, I'd like to thank my guests. Next week, Rory Kefflin-Jones is back in charge of the tent. So I do hope that you can join him, same time, same place.